in many more ways than I can now tell you here in Omaha. We have explored and we are continuing to explore avenues to peace with North Vietnam. But as of this moment, their only reply has been to send more troops and to send more guns into the South. And until the day they decide to end this aggression and to make an honorable peace, I can assure you that we, speaking for the United States of America, intend to carry on.
The year 1966, the President, Lyndon Johnson, speaking in Omaha, Nebraska, about a war which would change America forever. President Johnson had taken the fateful decision, only a year earlier, to plunge headlong into the Vietnam conflict. The sustained American bombing of North Vietnam was by now well underway, as was the huge escalation in the number of US troops on the ground. At home, questions about the wisdom of this policy were being asked by ever-growing numbers of people. Congressional investigations had begun. College campuses were heating up. It was also a time of huge social change in America. The struggle for civil rights for black people was morphing from Martin Luther King's firm but inclusive rhetoric into something wilder and more frightening. The Black Panthers were founded in 1966. There was talk of separatism and violence. Meanwhile, immigration from Asia and South America had greatly increased following changes in the quota system. And as if this were not enough, Lyndon Johnson had declared war on poverty, his Great Society program, increasing the role of the state in people's everyday lives, was passing through Congress. There was, inevitably, a backlash, a sense among some that too much was changing too quickly, a sense of nervousness about where this was leading, where it would all end, a sense that raised voices on the other side of the white picket fence, as it were beginning to spoil the serene lives of the post-war American middle class. America has always been a society balanced between the call of freedom, genuine freedom, to do your own thing, unbound by rules and regulations and other social constraints, and the call of discipline, the discipline of the founding fathers and of generations of Americans whose vision of the nation was of a place where God's work was done by obedient servants. Anyway, back to 1966. Of course, the explosion, the 1968 assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, the riots, the summer of love, all that was 2 years away. But Alastair Cook was plainly aware of a new mood and equally plainly felt the discomfort that it was beginning to cause.
Good evening. I suppose there will be general rejoicing that the newlywed Mr. and Mrs. Mayor Sugarman of Glencoe, Illinois, were able last Friday night to share their honeymoon in upstate New York with President Johnson, his accompanying regiment of aides, the White House Press Corps, and the Secret Service. I don't believe I've put that very well, but you must know the story. The bride and groom had come 1,000 miles to the rolling Catskill Mountains in New York State, and they expected, as every couple should, to have their bridal suite uninvaded when they came to shake the rice out of their shoulder blades. They did not know that on his trip into New York, New England, and up into Canada, the President of the United States would decide to stay overnight at their very motel. Few people know ahead of time these days where the President will stay when he's on the hop and when he will arrive. And I surely don't need to remind you of the sad necessity for this extra secrecy. Anyway, the Sugarmans had heard of the Catskills, a favorite and delectable landscape for lovers and golfers. They'd had their reservation confirmed. Then the White House moved in and made its discreet but all-embracing arrangements. It preempted, as it does, the rooms in any hotel that the President and his party mean to stay in. Imagine the scene in rural Illinois when Mr. Sugarman got a telegram from the hotel manager regretting that because of the visit of the presidential party, his honeymoon room had been cancelled. Mr. Sugarman is no trembling bachelor. He's 49, twice married, and he was very sore. He, in turn, sent a telegram to the President of the United States. And imagine that scene. The President, up to his eyes in cables from Vietnam, and the diplomatic pouch and aides trotting in with the latest information about the Canadian trip, and calls from businessmen and his economic advisers about the Federal Reserve tightening up credit, and an old friend, a senator, telling him he was going to have the nerve to ask for an increase in income taxes. And then somebody comes in with a special telegram from General Westmoreland in Saigon, no doubt. No, from Mayor Sugarman of Glencoe, Illinois. It read, "My honeymoon reservation cancelled Friday for convenience of your party. Very disturbed. Please correct." Now, the President, as we've lately heard at great and moving length, is very tender towards honeymoon couples. He'd never heard of Mayor Sugarman. But the President's own daughter did not have her honeymoon cottage preempted by any roving Caribbean dictator. A ridiculous episode may be, but this is an election year. Moreover, Mr. Sugarman took the precaution to add the warning note. "I am a former Democratic committeeman in two counties." The President was, as they say, in a bind. Now, imagine the triumph of Mayor Sugarman. He was fondly rehearsing on the telephone the details of the wedding with his third bride-to-be, and suddenly there was a click, and an operator cut in with the likely story that there was an urgent call from the White House. While the couple caught their breath, a White House secretary came on with the wild, the improbable remark, "The President wants you to have your room. You will receive a telegram confirming this." So the hotel manager reinstated the Sugarmans in their room, but the 99 others, who were not at one and the same time newlyweds and Democratic committeemen in two counties, were thrown out. The President, who never rushes in where angels fear to tread, must have figured, he may well have ordered a fast poll, that he would win more votes by bowing to Mr. and Mrs. Sugarman than the 99 he stands to lose from the outcasts. Although in the last century or so in this country, and more recently in other self-governing countries, the word democracy has been used to extinction, this little incident reminds us again that the word democracy has entered into such hallowed company as Santa Claus and Mother. It cannot be knocked, and in its name, anything goes. All it took to halt the President of the United States in his tracks was the gall of Mr. Mayor Sugarman in deciding to send that first telegram. It's something, I think, quite new in the relations between the rulers and the ruled. Of course, we all have our favorite anecdotes that demonstrate the humanity of the great. 102 years ago, a totally obscure lady in Boston received this letter. "Dear Madam, I have been shown in the files of the War Department a statement of the Adjutant General of Massachusetts that you are the mother of 5 sons who have died gloriously on the field of battle. I feel how weak and fruitless must be any words of mine which should attempt to beguile you from the grief of a loss so overwhelming. But I cannot refrain from tendering to you the consolation that may be found in the thanks of the Republic they died to save. Yours very sincerely and respectfully, Abraham Lincoln." Mrs. Bixby's letter is part of the national treasury, almost, you might say, of American literature. It is a sad undertone to the gay note of another letter written in reply to a small girl, a very small girl, about 7, I think, also from Illinois, who wrote to Lincoln and suggested that he'd look better with whiskers. He looked at the letter, pondered it, he thought so too, and he grew them. But these incidents are precious precisely because of their rarity. Everybody wants to lay some claim, however passing, to acquaintanceship with the great. It takes a Mayor Sugarman to demand it. It is not conceivable, I think, that any Englishman or woman at the time, let us say, of the coronation jubilee of King George V, would have written to Buckingham Palace and objected that the route of the royal procession passed by the bedroom of an ailing mother. If it happened today, in any democracy, there is a strong chance that the ruler, the leader, would have to acknowledge the protest, if not bow to it. All this is part of the trend, amounting to a tidal wave, which floods our rulers with the simple reminder that we put them there. For every Mrs. Bixby who endures the death of a son, let alone five sons, in battle, and is unheard of, the President of the United States now hears from 100 mothers, some of them proud, many of them furious. For every conscientious objector in other wars, there are now 5 or 10 young men of draft age who don't even cite their conscience. They simply don't see why anybody should send them to a war that they don't approve of. The energy, the power of this impulse has increased enormously in the United States, certainly in the last decade or so. It explains a good deal in America of what from the outside looks so often like an orgy of chaos and confusion. When I was a small boy, the idea of knowing your place was about as obvious and unchallengeable as the Ten Commandments. The children knew their place, so did the policeman, so did the cab driver, so did the soldier and the student and the wife and the voter. Now, as a famous American liberal remarked the other day, and he was an unlikely source for this remark, nobody knows his place. Everybody acts on the assumption not only that all men are created equal, but that all men stay equal in rights and in knowledge. I must say, this statesman added, since it throws the social discipline entirely on the individual, it makes governing a whole lot tougher than it used to be. He's right. J.P. Morgan could say, the public be damned. But Lyndon Johnson, at his peril, can deny Mr. and Mrs. Mayor Sugarman their motel reservation. Because Mr. Sugarman did what nobody 30 years ago would have dreamed of doing. He challenged the privilege of a president of the United States without a reservation to take the room of a plain citizen with a reservation. There are times when the heart bleeds for Lyndon Baines Johnson. We can say, I think, that in the last decade, we have played down the duties of democracy and had a ball with its privileges. Government may stumble, but democracy is a swinging thing. The Statue of Liberty wears Grecian folds and the posture of a queen. But today, the miniskirt has come to democracy. Good night.
The BBC's North America editor Justin Webb introduced the second of Alastair Cook's letters broadcast on the race to the White House over the past 60 years. The producer was Mark Savage. Tomorrow, Cook on the oddness of the American party political system. The Environment Minister, Phil Willis, has called for a new debate on genetically modified crops. You and Yours asks today the question, what role could GM play in an era of rising food prices and global food shortages? Is it the future for agriculture in the developing world? Could it bring down prices in the UK? And would you be willing to buy GM products? Call now on a new number, 03700 100 444. It'll cost no more than calls to ordinary 01 and 02 numbers. Or you can email via the Radio 4 website or text you and your message to 63399.
BBC News at 10 o'clock. New figures from the Nationwide Building Society.